from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, I interview our own Michael Krasny, who somehow found time between hosting Forum shows to write a book on Jewish humor. It's called Let There Be Laughter, and it celebrates and analyzes Jewish humor, its history, its cultural revelations, and, of course, its jokes. We talk with Michael about what makes Jewish jokes so distinct. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Many of you know Michael Krasny as the celebrated longtime host of this program. Lesser known is that he's quite the joke teller, collecting and telling Jewish jokes since his bar mitzvah. So in this hour Forum, Michael Krasny will be on the other side of the microphone talking about his new book that celebrates and analyzes Jewish humor called Let There Be Laughter, a treasury of great Jewish humor and what it all means, which also claims more than 100 of the funniest Jewish jokes of all time. Michael is also a professor of English and American Literature and the author of two other books, Off Mic, a memoir of talk radio and literary life, and Spiritual Envy, an Agnostic's Quest. Good morning, Michael Krasny.
Good morning, Mina Kim.
Congratulations on the book.
Thank you kindly.
I didn't realize before reading it, and it became so obvious to me as I was, that there are so many comedians who are Jewish, and that what there was a stat you had that some 80% are involved in the comedy world, whether as performers or writers.
Well, that stat needs a little annotation. That was a figure that Steve Allen, who is not Jewish, came up with many years ago, and he was talking about stand-up comics, people who write comedy, people who are in the comedy business, so to speak. It's probably gone down considerably since then, but at one time the domination was pretty clear and it was extraordinary. I mean, it can't be overstated.
And why do you think that is?
It's one of the questions I wanted to get at
exactly.
In this book. I wanted to plumb into and so forth. I mean, you know, the old standard answer had been these were generations of Jews who were cut off from the old world and they were dealing with themes of assimilation and also with suffering and so forth from the shtetl. But there's a lot more to it than that. I think it's a hybridization of the American experience with the experiences in Eastern Europe, for the most part, Ashkenazi experiences. But it evolved as really in some ways a kind of business for Americans, and a lot of it had to do with the kind of irony and paradox and way of seeing the world that Jews have traditionally had.
Well, give us an example of some of your favorite Jewish jokes. I know it's hard to pick favorites because there's so many of them, but give us one.
It's hard, but I'll give you one or two, or as many as you want, actually. You know, you're in the driver's seat here today. There's a joke particularly people like about, and I'll just use it as an example of this kind of setup that reveals in many people's minds what Jewish humor is all about. It's a classic joke about you have to sort of accept these frames, and they may sound incredible on the face of it, but there's a Jew and an Italian and a Frenchman and a Mexican, and they're all climbing this huge peak together, and they get to the top, and the Frenchman says, I'm tired and I'm thirsty, I must have some champagne. And the Italian says, I'm tired and I'm thirsty, I must have some wine. And the Mexican says, I'm tired and I'm thirsty, I must have some tequila. And the Jew says, I'm tired and I'm thirsty, I must have diabetes. Now, it's a joke that has to do, I suppose, with the notion that Jews kvetch more or complain more. But it's also a joke about distinctiveness, that they see themselves in many ways. And this is where I was trying to use jokes as I use narratives or as I use news stories to try to analyze what's behind the joke and what does it mean and get at that meaning. Another one that's a favorite, and it's a favorite of many people, is the one about the older Jewish grandmother who takes her grandson to the beach and he's playing really near the ocean front, and suddenly a big wave takes him and the grandmother is hysterical, terrorized. This is her pride and joy and she can't swim and she's screaming and praying, and suddenly, almost miraculously, young man, very robust and well-built, comes out, dives into the brine, saves the kid, brings him up, gives him artificial respiration, mouth to mouth, and says, even while he's spurting water, your grandson, is going to be okay. She nods and she says, he had a hat.
There was a theme in there where It was interesting when you bring up Jewish grandmothers, because that's actually how you open the book. You talk about Jewish mothers and Jewish grandmothers. And one of the stereotypes that you hit on with this particular joke is that you can't please them. Where does that come from?
Not sure where it comes from, but it probably does come – that goes, has roots in the old world. You know, it was the typical situation in the shtetl, and by the shtetl I mean, you know, the impoverished what we call ghettos of Eastern Europe the Jews lived in. It was almost an archetypical situation where the mother would be responsible for everything, even trying to put bread on the table, because it was the job really of the husband to study and to be closer to God and to study Talmud and Torah and so forth. So the mothers had so much – I mean, this is why – you know, there are a lot of jokes in here that I suppose could be called sexist and even misogynistic, but I really wanted to get at, in an analytic way, how much they mirror the toughness of Jewish women and how much they speak to that and the independence of them, too. I mean, you take something like the so-called Jewish American princess jokes, which offend a lot of people, and as I think a good card-carrying feminist, I understand that. But at the same time, they're talking about really the sheer sense of success. These are pampered. And it's patriarchal, and it goes back to the idea of patriarchy, which is Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, all the way back to the Bible, and the sense that women have a strong sense of will, and they're admired for their toughness in a lot of these jokes. But the complaining and the stereotyping is almost a different kind of, well, how can I describe it to you? It's like, on the one hand, Henny Youngman, take my wife, please. You know, it's that sort of thing. It's aggression released. But it falls into an entirely different dimension of jokes that are based on stereotypes. And so many of these jokes are based on stereotypes. I mean, how do you get away from stereotypes that are embedded in the American popular culture? And they have become embedded, like, you know, the helicopter mom, the tiger mom. I mean, these are simply all a part of this kind of fabric of stereotypes.
There is a fine line, you're right, between presenting something in an academic light and advancing potentially a sexist joke, for example. How did you manage that line? How did you decide what was appropriate to include and not to include?
I felt it was almost duty-bound to include jokes because I was really about the serious business of analyzing them, jokes that may indeed not seem politically correct because, frankly, a lot of them didn't seem politically correct to me. And it is a fine line, but ultimately you go with the idea that these jokes are out there. They're already part of the world. Some of them are transgenerational. Let's put them out there, put them in print, and see if we can deal with what their meaning is. So it was really, in some respects, a very a tripartite process because I wanted to talk about the jokes, have people read the jokes and celebrate them at the same time that I wanted to get at their meaning. And at the same time also weave in anecdotes, which I did a lot too. I confess that I had a lot of stories in my quiver that I wanted to include in this book, and I did.
And we're talking with Michael Krasny. He's written a new book. It's called Let There Be Laughter, A Treasury of Great Jewish Humor and What It All Means. He, of course, is the host of Forum on KQED Public Radio. And I should also note that Michael...
Friday's Mina is the host. Let's get that straight fact.
So what was not... Where did you draw the line? What were things that you did not include? What did you think was, okay, it can't go in here?
Well, there are jokes that are simply too radioactive in my mind and too inappropriate, especially for today. And some of them, you know, probably in some people's minds ought to have been included. The fact that they're verboten makes them in some ways more interesting. But the fact of the matter is I had to go by my inner Geiger counter. And I also, like with some of these jokes about Jewish women, I consulted a lot of Jewish women friends, my wife and so forth. And everybody gave the green light. They said they should be in there. So you have to kind of go like a bat in a cave by what your radar tells you with these things. I don't think I'm, you know, seriously trying to put out jokes that are offensive, though they may offend some people. In fact, one of my listeners got a hold of the book very early on and expressed some concern about that. And I told her what my intentions were. And she said, well, I knew you were a good guy, you know, but the jokes are in there. And so they're in there because they're out in the world, really.
Can you tell the joke about the guru?
Yeah, and it's one of those favorite jokes of many people, particularly out here in Northern California. The joke goes that there's a woman, and again, it's, you know, a tough old Jewish woman who, in this case, joins a very young kind of Sierra Club hiking group, and they're going to go up this huge mountain. Call it, in fact, the Himalayas, because it should be, this joke should be set in the East, and I don't mean Brooklyn. So they climb up this arduous climb again. Not all these jokes have arduous climbs in them. And when they get to the top, the leader of the group says there's a guru, or a guru, some people prefer, in a cave, and everybody can go in and speak to him, but you can only say three words. He is nominal, and he only allows three words to be spoken to him. But this is a really extraordinary opportunity to meet this incredible guru. So they file in one by one, including Mrs. Rosenblum, who, you know, can hardly walk. They're amazed at the grit she showed getting up to the top of this mountain. She comes out, and the leader says, "Mrs. Rosenblum, did you see the guru?" "Yes, I saw the guru." "And did you say three words to him?" "Yes, I said three words to him." "And could I ask you, do you mind, what those three words were? I'm just curious." "I said, 'Sheldon, come home.'" Okay. So now, it's a very funny joke, especially with all the so-called Jewish bagel Buddhists. They call them out here Jew-boos. I told that joke to Peter Coyote. I told it to Ram Dass. Beware of name dropping here, but it's true. And you know, they both happen to be of Jewish background. They love the joke, as you can imagine, as many people do. But it's a joke, again, that has a deeper meaning. It's like she's saying, come home to Judaism, you know, where you belong. It's also the Jewish mother in that stereotypical role of foisting guilt on her son.
That's part of the reason that I wanted you to talk about that joke, because it bridges together what we were talking about this stereotype of very strong Jewish women that can be overbearing at times as well, that figure a lot in terms of the jokes in this book. But there's also this – it expresses something that you talk about later in the book in a chapter that focuses on assimilation and this concern over a loss of Jewish identity.
It's implicit in so much of the humor. And, you know, we're coming up on the Jewish holidays, and I was asked to write a piece about this. And so I was thinking about jokes, and there are a lot of them, about Yom Kippur, which is, you know, the highest, most sacred, solemn holiday in the Jewish calendar. But there are a lot of jokes that sort of reveal assimilation or movement away from what Tevye would have screamed tradition, you know. And here are three modern rabbis arguing about which of the three is the most progressive. I'll set the joke up for you. I'm definitely the most progressive. The first one says we allow smoking during services. But the second one says that's nothing. We serve pork spare ribs during Yom Kippur. You know, you're supposed to fast on Yom Kippur and you're not supposed to eat pork spare ribs if you're kosher. And not bad, replies the third. Some of these are set up with three. But I have y'all beat. During Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, we post signs at my temple, closed for the holidays. It's an assimilation joke, really. I actually told an assimilation joke. I had Vikram Seth on, a great Indian writer, and he had written a book about his uncle, who was a dentist who married a survivor of the Holocaust. And what was interesting about that, it was, I think, probably one of the only Jewish jokes I ever told on the air. But it was fascinating because it was to him, because it was really an assimilation joke. So the joke goes like this. It's the Second World War, and a young man is able to escape, and he goes to England, and he makes a fortune in England. And he's very happy with this. So he's becoming more and more assimilated, but he wants to save his father, who's in the Warsaw Ghetto. And now that he's very wealthy, he can get a helicopter and stage a daring rescue, and they do, and they bring him into London. And he says to his father, I want you to think of yourself as an Englishman now. This country has given me sanctuary, and now I want you to, as much as you can, see yourself like I see myself as an Englishman. So first he takes him out to Bond Street, and he gets a whole new suit for him. And then he takes him to a tonsorial place, and they start cutting his hair. And they're cutting his hair, and he starts sobbing. The old man starts sobbing, and his son says, what is it? Pa, what is it? You're losing your Jewish identity, you feel, because of the cutting of the hair? And he says, and the payas, to the curls? He says, no, I'm crying because we lost India. So it's a hysterical joke, but it's also, of course, an assimilation joke. How fast Jews have been able to assimilate.
And is this something that you – this feels a little bit like almost an elegy to Yiddish language and culture. Do you feel like – do you have concerns about, you know, Jewish identity getting lost in this day and age?
Well, you've hit on something I think that is, to me, quite – significant and real in writing this book. I felt like in some ways I was writing an elegy, even though I wanted to be very upbeat, and people were saying, and they're saying to me now even more, we need laughter, you know, thank you. This is what we, especially this political season. But the truth of the matter is I realized that a lot of this Yiddishkeit, Yiddish culture, as has happened with assimilation, this is the two sides of any kind of assimilation, especially when you move down generations. And when I've given lectures on this, I've had people come up to me and say, how am I going to teach my grandparents about this sort of thing? How are they going to learn anything about it? There's even a joke about, Israel, of course, they all speak Hebrew. And there's a joke about an Israeli woman who's teaching her children, speaking to them only exclusively in Yiddish. And one of the neighbors says, what are you doing this for? You know, we decided this is going to be a Hebrew-speaking country. And she says, I don't want them to forget they're Jewish. So that's how tied Yiddishkeit is to Jewishness. And I say Jewishness because let's separate Judaism, the religion, from Jewishness. This is a Philip Roth binary, but it's one that makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah. Michael Krasny, he is our guest for this hour. He is our longtime forum host, an English professor at San Francisco State University, and he has a new book, Let There Be Laughter, A Treasury of Great Jewish Humor and What It All Means. Interestingly, though, there's also jokes in there about how folks are starting to return to or wanting to hearken back to the old world or to bring and make more distinctive Jewish culture and identity in their lives, making it more known and obvious. And there was this joke about Scott and Shlomo. Can you talk about that joke?
Well, you know, I actually told that joke over the weekend because Scott Simon, no less, asked me to tell the joke. He goes, it was a joke with my name
of
in
NPR,
it when I was on NPR. And by the way, for those of you who don't realize the power of NPR, I mean, we now have more listeners on National Public Radio. Can I sort of put on our own little promo here? Then the combined, this is what I tell people when I talk to patrons and supporters of NPR, then the combined viewers of CNBC, CNN, and Fox. And I realized this after doing Scott Simon and Weekend Edition, because the numbers on Amazon just shot up astronomically, the likes of which I'd never experienced. Suddenly I find myself ahead of Amy Schumer and Ta-Nehisi Coates. But the joke you're asking about, Mina, has to do with, and it's kind of a hopeful joke, and it's a joke I really like. A man is walking with his son. It's the middle of the 21st century, and somebody walks up and says, your son is a very handsome boy. I want to tell you that. The man says, thank you. I'm flattered, and so is my son. The kid nods his head and says, what's the boy's name? He says, Shlomo. He says, Shlomo? He says, what kind of name is Shlomo? He says, well, he's named after his dead grandfather, whose name was Scott. So there's a sense that generations are moving maybe in a cyclical way in that joke, but it's also a way of talking again about maybe going back and maybe recovering some of the traditional kinds of things.
Is it true, Michael, that you started collecting jokes in high school?
Probably in high school, yeah.
And what was it about jokes that made you say, this is something that I want to hang on to, this is important for me to start gathering?
I think it was just a desire to have those jokes in a kind of a quiver or in a repertoire and build it up. You know, the way some people build up a stamp collection or a coin collection. I mean, it says in the book something about in some of the reviews, I know more jokes than, you know, anybody. But it's ridiculous. I don't know that I can say that. I haven't done any empirical research on it. Just like it says 100, more than 100 of the funniest Jewish jokes of all time. Well, that's true, but I didn't want it necessarily to be seen just as a joke book. You could certainly, there are a lot of Jewish joke books out there, but there aren't any books that really talk about not only what the jokes mean, but try to tie them into motifs and leitmotifs and, you know, serious kinds of stuff that this book is about. Spending my all of that life translating and interpreting literature, and what jokes are really small works of literature. They're narratives.
You call them portals of knowledge, I think, in your book.
Well, I think they are portals of knowledge. They're also things that make us laugh and bring humor to us and mirth, and that's a great thing about jokes in general. But I got hooked early on Freud's book, which is all about jokes and the unconscious, and I wanted to probe that, but also the cultural and historical and well beyond that. I think I just wanted to have that repertoire. But then as time went on, I realized these were important. These were preserving the past. They were ways of seeing the whole metamorphosis of a people, of a tribe. And I've done enough studying of indigenous tribes, for example, to realize that what's sacred, what's meaningful, what's so much in their values is in their language and is in their folklore and is in their tales and stories. That's it.
That's
the epiphany, if you will.
And you were inspired by Freud's jokes and their relation to the unconscious and how he talks about how jokes discharge aggression and anxiety and conceal repressed feelings, that there's real intimacy in jokes.
There is, and I wanted to convey that, and I wanted to show that, and I think that's what the book offers.
And when you talk about history, too, in the experience of a people or a tribe. I was also struck by you had a section where you talked about Jack Benny and how he could not share his Jewish identity.
Well, there are people who knew Jack Benny who say to me, I didn't care that much about it or whatever, but others who have said otherwise. Yeah, he was Jewish, and he was certainly in some ways stronger in Jewish identity than you would ever imagine, because it never, ever came up on the Jack Benny show. Remember, this was right after the Second World War, and there was a lot of fear of being essentially out there as a Jew. Arthur Miller wrote a great American play called Death of a Salesman, and I believe disguised Willie Loman. A lot of locutions in that play that suggest Willie Loman was Jewish, although, like Lenny Bruce said, if you're from New York, you're Jewish, or New Jersey even, some say. And they speak a certain way that seems Jewish. But I think Benny had to keep it probably concealed. They had Christmas trees. They had all of those kinds of things on the old Jack Benny show when it was on television. Fast forward to Seinfeld, and they're kind of milking all this Jewish humor. They have an episode called Schick's Appeal. You know, Schick's used to be a word that was full of opprobrium. Now it's become kind of almost an American regular lexicon word.
It refers to a non-Jewish woman.
Exactly. It refers to a Gentile or non-Jewish woman. I even saw a license plate that said Schick's. But they started doing all these things on Seinfeld that were related to Jewish. And you can tell, I mean, the writers are Seinfeld and Larry David. You can tell, for example, that George, they said, well, we don't want to make this too Semitic, so let's de-Semiticize it. Let's make him from a Greek family or make him have a Greek name. But the parents are so almost stereotypically Jewish that it's deceptive.
George Costanza, yeah. Yeah. What's interesting is, through this history of having to deal with anti-Semitism and having to conceal your Jewish identity, right, to be able to be appealing to a broader audience. And then fast forward to this time now where we're much more willing, like with the Shlomo joke, to try to be distinctive in our cultural identity. That within that process, there is a lot of cultural ambivalence, feelings of inferiority and self-loathing that a lot of these jokes get to. You know, I'm thinking of the J.P. Morgan joke or, you know, Groucho Marx's famous words about not being a member of a club that would have him as a member.
Yeah, those are both good examples. I suppose you're giving me a lead here. Thank you for that. No, Groucho Marx did say he would not join any club that wanted him as a member. He also said when he was told he would not be able to get into a club because he was Jewish and would not be able to swim in the pool even in the club. He said, well, what about my daughter? She's half Jewish. Can she go up to her waist in the pool? Those are memorable lines. Groucho was not at all afraid or timorous about revealing his Jewish identity. The J.P. Morgan story fascinated me, and I did some research on it because it's about a Jewish guy who moves next door to J.P. Morgan, the great industrialist and captain of industry and multimillionaire. And has a very similar lawn, has similar cars. In fact, they're identical cars, hires the same gardeners and people like that, have the same kind of swimming pool. J.P. Morgan one day says to him, you think you're as good as I am, don't you? And the Jewish guy says, no, I think I'm better than you. What are you talking about? He says, I don't have a Jew living next to me.
We're talking with Michael Krasny. He is the author of Let There Be Laughter, A Treasury of Great Jewish Humor and What It All Means. It's a new book that celebrates and analyzes Jewish humor and explores what makes Jewish humor so distinct. If you have a question for Michael, give us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org, post them on Facebook, on our website, kqed.org/forum, or on Twitter. I'm Mina Kim. Do stay with us. More with Michael Krasny after the break. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. This hour, we are talking with Michael Krasny, Forum host of 20 plus years. He's on the other side of the mic talking about his new book, Let There Be Laughter, A Treasury of Great Jewish Humor and What It All Means. And it also claims to have more than 100 of the funniest Jewish jokes of all time. You may not have realized that Michael Krasny is both a host of serious and newsworthy topics and also quite the joke teller. And he brings it all together in this analysis of Jewish humor and what makes Jewish humor so distinct. I'd like our listeners to get involved, and we've got lots of calls and comments coming in. So a listener writes It must be remembered that in years past, a Jewish man who became a comedian was almost automatically meeting with his mother's extreme disapproval. An engineer, civil service worker, doctor, or lawyer was the hope or the security of the son or of the family, but never a comedian. Defensive aggression and jokes in return was only natural.
I think that's an astute observation. I would agree, at least in part. There's also the sense of the Jewish mother being overly protective and overly demanding and overly insistent on, there's a Yiddish word for this, nachas. They wanted, in other words, pride. They wanted their sons to do well by them, which often meant going into a profession, often meant being a doctor. But, you know, we do see this certainly in many other cultures, and it shows a lot of the crossover and why Jewish humor is so universal in many people's minds, including mine. It can be universal, but it's also distinct. That's the wonderful paradox about it. And, you know, we were talking before about PC humor and, you know, putting the jokes out there and everything. There is a kind of sense of the freedom of these jokes to go after the stereotypes in ways that may include some discomfort, you know, about the smothering mothers and the mothers who, you know, I know my own mother, for example, was a fairly meek and passive woman. So none of those stereotypes. When Philip Roth wrote Portnoy's Complaint about the Uber mother, the mother of all Jewish mothers, if you will, you know, she's a woman who would sit there with a knife while her son was eating to make sure, and he felt that she was going to use a knife on him. But his own mother, he said on a number of occasions, was really, you know, very soft and soft-spoken and all the rest of that, very serious, dedicated to, you know, her temple and her community and all those kinds of things. So the stereotypes tend to go on, and they tend to almost, you say, well, why push them even further? They're out there. There's a sense of the freedom about them. And the Jewish comics made a lot about their mothers and their wives.
Well, speaking of mothers, Robert asks, Dr. Krasny, which came first, the Jewish deathbed Kugel joke or the identical Scandinavian-American Ole and Lena joke of the upper Midwest?
It's a wonderful question. It's almost impossible to determine what came first. There's a joke, for example, and you know, this would be considered perhaps by some Jews to be a joke that could be interpreted as being generalizing stereotypes about Jews and so forth. But the joke goes something like this. I'll get back to the Kugel joke. A priest comes in and he gets a haircut, and it's the first time he's had a haircut from this particular barber. And he goes to pay the barber, and he says, "No, you're a man of the cloth. This is for free." Next day, the barber goes outside to get the newspaper, and there's a crucifix there with a thank you note. Minister comes in, same thing. It's his first barber haircut with this particular barber. Goes to pay him, says, "No." He says, "You're a clergyman. You're a man of the cloth, a man of God. I won't take any money from you." Goes out the next morning, and there's a Bible there. Then a rabbi comes in, and he says the same thing, and he goes out the next morning, and there are 12 rabbis there. You know, it's a joke, again, about rabbis getting a deal, about Jews getting a deal. However, Amy Tan, no less, another name drop, but happened to tell me that joke because she knew I was a joke collector, but it was about Chinese men outside. And there are a lot of jokes about doctors and Jews, but they're also tied to Chinese and doctors. And so you see these jokes kind of crossing over, and you don't know what was the origination of them. What is Jewish Alzheimer's? You forget everything but the grudges. You know, I heard that joke about Sicilians. I heard it about Arabs. I heard it about Irish and so forth. Where did it originate? Who knows? But it shows the wonderful universality of a lot of these jokes.
Well, it's interesting. Before reading your book, when I was reading the humor and hearing the jokes, I associated it more with New York culture. That was my thinking was, these sound like folks I interacted with in New York or the types of jokes that I would hear them say. How much is New York culture and Jewish humor intertwined?
Very much so. Just like Jewish humor and American humor are intertwined. We talk about a lot of the great stand-up comics. They're not all Jewish, obviously, but they draw from a lot of the Jewish humor, just like the Jewish comics draw from a lot of the other humors out there. I said, Lenny Bruce once said, if you're from New York, you're Jewish. If you're from Montana, you can worship at a synagogue, but you're not Jewish. I mean, it's the difference between, I suppose, in subtext, what's provincial and what's seen as more cosmopolitan, more hip and so forth, but also New York aggression. A lot of the jokes about, you know, the woman who gets off from the Midwest and goes up to a stranger in New York and says, "I know I should go blank myself, but could you help me with directions first?" It's the attitude of New Yorkers. And you compare a lot of those New York Jewish jokes, I mean, especially one that the name that many of our listeners may recognize, Bobby Slayton told me, and you realize these are jokes that are designed to show how far we are from the shtetl, because where do they land? They landed, most of them, in New York, and there was a whole culture that grew out of that, and the culture said, we're tough now. I'm sorry. this joke may not be for prime time, so I'll hold it off on it.
Okay. So then how would a book like this go over in Israel then?
Well, I deal with Israeli humor. In fact,
you do.
Our beloved producer, Judy Campbell, said, do you remember you told me a joke that I loved about – the joke goes something like this, and it was fascinating because Judy had it framed in her mind as having to do with World War II, which is not how I tell the joke, but it works in that vein. So a man is taking a survey, and he goes up to an American, a Russian, a Pole, and an Israeli, and he says, excuse me, gentlemen, excuse me, but I'm taking a survey. I want to know your opinion on the meat shortage. And the Polish guy says, what's meat? And the Russian says, what's an opinion? And the American says, what's a shortage? And the Israeli says, what's excuse me? Now, that could be also used, I suppose, about New Yorkers, but it's also a way of saying Israelis, you know, can be pretty brusque and pretty tough and pretty aggressive, too. And that, I suppose, is really the point of the joke.
There was also the canoe joke that really made me laugh about. I think it might be too much to tell here on the
air. Well, we can censor. You kind of prompted it before. And so did that caller asking about the Kugel joke. I don't get a feast of jokes here. But the Kugel joke is a wonderful joke. And there are many versions of it. Again, Scott Simon asked me to tell it on Weekend Edition. A man is dying, and he's on his deathbed, and his daughter is dutiful, and she's sitting there with him, and she's, of course, waiting for the shade to go down. He's really on the precipice of death, and suddenly he says, and he can barely speak, I smell kugel, which is, of course, a famous Jewish food, noodle kugel especially. And she says, Mom is making a kugel. And he says, can barely even say the words, to taste kugel once before I die. Of course, Daddy. And she races into the kitchen, and she comes out, and she folds her hands, and she says nothing. And he can – gossamer's threads he's hanging on. Where's the kugel? She says, Mom says it's for after. So there's that mother again, but that mother who's, you know, very practical. She's concerned about – the other thing is what Mom says is for the shiva, which means the morning people who are going to come and visit. But she's practical about the shiva that she's going to have to do.
Well, let's go to some of our callers. Wynn in Menlo Park. Hi, Wynn.
Hi. It seems strange to ask you the question, Michael, but do you think that there's something like a poetic license where it's okay for Jews to tell all the Jewish jokes, but if other groups told those jokes, they wouldn't go over well, and the same with Jewish comedians doing the same thing?
I think it's a good point and a worthy point. And in fact, it's the same thing with a lot of African Americans. You know, they can tell jokes about themselves and do, and some of the jokes, if they were told by white people, look out. You know, there's that element to Jewish humor, but Jewish humor has become so assimilated and so much a part of American humor that sometimes it's really hard to find where one begins and the other ends.
Ben asks, was it hard for your guests to keep the book funny since analyzing jokes makes them anything but funny? That was also a question I think Scott Simon had asked you over the weekend about kind of takes the steam out of the joke when you've analyzed it so much.
Well, it was a big challenge for me. I don't know if it takes the steam out of the joke. You know, just navigating through the writing of this book and keeping the jokes coming, I wanted to do that almost relentlessly. Not only jokes, but stories and anecdotes, as I said, and quips and shtick and folklore and so forth. You know, you can go to see a movie and you can come out of it. What did it mean? You interpret it. You analyze it. You read a novel, the same thing. I've been doing that my whole life. You read the news and you interpret it and analyze it. Some people say it takes some of the joy away. Maybe for some people it does. But nevertheless, it's what I wanted to do.
And it's so much who you are, I feel like, a marriage of your analytical side and your – did you ever flirt with the idea of being a comedian? Because you've done routines, right?
Well, I have done routines. In fact, I was in a stand-up celebrity contest here for a good charity, and one of the celebrities was Rachel Gordon. She took first place. She used to cover the City Hall for the Chronicle.
That's right.
I took second place with a lot of Jewish jokes. I think she had a great local Jewish joke. With all deference to, I think I can call him certainly someone I've known many years and respected, Willie Brown. But the joke, Willie had a bridge named after him, and he also at the time wanted to have a street named after him. And Rachel gets up there, and Willie was at the event, and says, "Well, the obvious name of a street is Lombard Street because it's the crookedest street in the world." And of course, Willie laughed at this too, but it's a great joke. She took first place. I took second. I did some shtick through the years at Esalen, and at one point, many people remember the Holy City Zoo got up and thought, "Nah, I'm not a comic, really. I like to tell jokes. I like to write about jokes, and I like to analyze jokes, but I'm not really a comic."
We're talking with Michael Krasny, who's written a new book, Let There Be Laughter, A Treasury of Great Jewish Humor and What It All Means. Michael will be discussing his new book with Peter Coyote at the Commonwealth Club on Wednesday at 6:30 p.m. There's a couple more appearances here I want to highlight. On October 22nd, he'll be at the National Kidney Foundation Literary Luncheon, and on October 24th at City Arts and Lectures at the Norse Theater with Calvin Trillin. You can find more appearances for Michael about his book at kqed.org/forum. And let me go to some more calls. Rob in San Francisco. Hi, Rob.
Hey. Hi. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Rob.
So I was raised by an East Coast Catholic mother, which is just like the poor man's Jewish mother. Not as much guilt, but more somber. So
Rob. Forgive me for jumping in here, but John Stewart once said he's Jewish, his wife's Catholic. They're raising their kids to be sad.
Exactly. God bless that man. I want him back so bad. So I wanted to ask about the proliferation of Borscht Belt humor. It's always sort of been my favorite era, and I feel like it sort of died out with Henny Youngman and Don Rickles, and I wanted to know if you explored that in your book at all.
I do, and I do a lot of that humor because it goes back to Yiddish roots in many ways. You know, when Don Rickles talk so caustically, it's a way of showing that aggression, releasing that aggression, but also being defensive in many respects. You mentioned Henny Youngman. Love those old Henny Youngman jokes. I went to the doctor. The doctor told me I was sick. I said, I'm going to get another opinion. He said, okay, you're ugly too. You know, and they have that kind of chigaboom that you identify also with Rodney Dangerfield to a great extent. You know, a woman told me to come to her house at night. She said nobody would be home. I went. Nobody was home. You know, they have a certain kind of rhythm and cadence, and they're fascinating because the pedigree goes back to Yiddishkeit once again. But they also say, look, I'm a schlemiel, you know, in many respects, and I try to deal with the whole figure of the schlemiel. That's a figure right out of Jewish folklore.
Rob, thanks so much for the question. Can you talk a little bit more about your whole section on schlemiels and schmucks? You really tested
to watch
my
it with
ability
that word
to speak.
Can you say chutzpah, Mina? Can
I hear chutzpah.
You say, yeah, good.
Used to be. I like the chutzpah joke, too.
All these broadcasters who couldn't say Menachem Begin, for example, they couldn't do that chutz sound. They say if you really have chutzpah, you have to say it like chutzpah. I'm sorry, you asked me about which...
We talked a lot about how women could be denigrated through jokes, but there is this whole section of about men, and they called them schlemiels and...
I think schmuck is an acceptable word. Now, Lenny Bruce once said that the reason he was arrested for obscenity was there was a Yiddish undercover cop when he did his bit and he used the word schmuck. But the word has evolved in different ways, like the word shiksa, which was terribly derogatory word, pejorative word, and now has become commonplace. Schmuck at one point really meant a villain, a terrible person, and now it's just kind of a loser for many people to use it in that way. But I tell some of the jokes that are allied to the original notion of villains and the like. And as far as schlemiels are concerned, you know, this goes back to Woody Allen before he got in trouble in terms of transgressions and all that. It goes back even to Charlie Chaplin, who was not Jewish, but, you know, it's the... character in Al Capp's Little Abner, who has a cloud above his head, who spills soup. The schlemazel, meaning the bad luck guy, is the one the soup falls upon. And that's kind of the two sides in many ways, the binary nature of a lot of this Yiddish culture in terms of those stereotypes. It's the villain and the person who needs to be called into question because of aggression and so forth. And then there's the loser who is just constantly tripping on things and doing things wrong.
There's also the other binary of, you know, self-laceration, but also propping someone up as the chosen and the superior and the distinct and different in all these jokes.
There is, and that's something I really wanted to get at, and I think I did get at in ways that were really illuminating, and I hope will be for readers, illuminating to me. The self-propping up is often self-inflation. I mean, sometimes it's just joking. I interviewed Jackie Mason, for example, a number of years ago, and he said, I said to him, you know, I saw your act last night. You must really practice. You must really get down like an actor. He said, this is the stupidest thing anybody's ever said to me. I said, what are you talking about? He said that I should have to go through training and actually practice and rehearse, a comic genius like myself. So there's all that kind of hyperbole and exaggeration. By the way, when we concluded the interview, I said, thank you. I enjoyed being with you. Of course you enjoyed it. You didn't have to pay a cent. You were with me all the time.
He's quick.
But the self-aggrandizement and the self-inflation often comes out of insecurity. Many people say that about the Republican nominee. There's also, though, in that a sense, as you suggested, of chosenness. And the chosen people, I pointed out and really wanted to point out, does not mean that you're special and that you're superior and that you should feel chauvinistic. It goes back to the Bible in the Old Testament. The Jews were chosen to have God's law on Sinai to be handed, and they were even second choice on that. You know, so the idea that some Jews have come by through the ages that we are the chosen people, and the Mormons say that about Jews too. So it's not just Jews about themselves, but it does play a role.
Yes, and it's these contradictions. What I felt like I really heard through your book was that the humor helps deal with the tension of contradictions. It's kind of like, well, you can't win, right? They both exist, so just embrace them both.
Well, it's almost, I go back to a non-Jewish source, one of my early idols, Ralph Waldo Emerson, who said, you know, hypocrisy is the essence of life, and maybe it is in some ways. That, or Walt Whitman, do I contradict myself? Well, I contradict myself. I'm large. I contain multitudes. And that's what a lot of this humor is indeed communicating.
Well, we've got a lot of comments I want to read here. Bill writes, my father was unfortunately anti-Semitic, but he loved Jack Benny, Phil Silvers, Mel Brooks, and many other Jewish comedians. He knew they were Jewish, but somehow did not associate that with their humor. I like to think that Jewish humor has a role in at least diluting fervent anti-Semitism.
That would be nice to think.
Al writes, the greatest Jewish illustration on the Seinfeld show was Jerry's parents learning he was spied necking madly at the movie Schindler's List.
Well, you think about something as verboten as that. And frankly, there's a lot of Holocaust humor now. There's a whole movie out about
yes.
Holocaust humor that has gotten a lot of attention. There's an old saying, there's no business like Shoah business. And Shoah is indeed the word for the Holocaust,
right.
Probably the correct word for the Holocaust. And again, you take something as tragic as that and you turn it into humor. For a while, it was very verboten. I'll tell you, Mel Brooks deserves a lot of credit because Springtime for Hitler with the Busby Berkeley dancers and so forth was something that just turned everything around. But before that, it was something you couldn't joke about. And now, I mean, Larry David, Curb Your Enthusiasm, invite a survivor. A friend played by Shelley Berman, that is getting trapped up here in my own labyrinth of jokes here. Shelley Berman plays Larry David's father on Curb Your Enthusiasm, and they invite, a rabbi suggests, can I have another survivor come and meet your friend, the survivor, Solly? And they bring him over, and it turns out he's from the TV show Survivor. And they're arguing about who had it worse. The guys, I was in Auschwitz, you know, and the survivors tell me I had to wear thongs and I had mosquitoes and, you know, we didn't have enough treats. I mean, it's crazy in some ways, but it's also funny.
You're right that Holocaust humor, you make the point that it's no longer forbidden, though I couldn't help but think, depending on who's telling it.
It's just what you said about Jews telling jokes that
yep.
sometimes, you know.
Which Paul writes, why is this night like no other night? I'm sure Michael knows this joke. It is especially appropriate around the annual Seder. I used to have a column and blog in a local newspaper, and I posted the joke on my site. I'm not Jewish, and the wrath from Jews in town was unbelievable. It is a funny joke. I learned it from a Jewish friend, but it appeared from the reaction I got was that it is off limits for a Gentile to tell even the most innocuous joke that includes something Jewish. What
well, that's
is,
just
Michael?
That's foolish and that's silly. I mean, because it is a great joke, and if you understand it, it becomes even better. It's one of those jokes, though, that really in some ways is distinctively Jewish. It's about a man who's going to be knighted. He's a great physicist, and he kneels down before the queen with a number of other men who are being knighted. Notice there aren't many women being knighted. And he's got a yarmulke on, a skull cap, and the queen says, why is this knight different from all other knights? And really, on the Passover Seder, that's a question that's asked by the youngest of the Seder, and every Jew, of course, knows that and understands that. Manishtana halayla hazeh, you know. But the fact is, it's not just a Jewish joke, and yet it is just a Jewish joke. It's a joke. Jokes are for everybody.
Well, Bob in Oakland. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Michael, I'm sure I'm going to get your book, and I look forward to reading it. I'm Jewish, and I know a rabbi, I also consider him a good friend, who tells everyone in his circle, do not send me via email any Jewish joke. And he says that because he has a conviction that it is so likely to be anti-Semitic. And I'd like you to explain how you navigated this whole issue in writing the book. I, for one, I mean, I don't know how other people react. I feel like the J.P. Morgan joke you told is anti-Semitic. I feel like the barber joke is anti-Semitic. But I want to read your book, and I tell Jewish jokes myself. But it's a tricky subject. So could you explain?
It is a tricky subject, and thank you for mentioning just how tricky it was for me. I can tell you it was. It's first of all, it depends on how you define anti-Semitism. I mean, a lot of people are not all that uncomfortable, like your rabbi friend. But you also, I think, have to realize that, and I go to some pains to point this out, that there's a vacillation in America between, perhaps unlike no other country in the world, between anti-Semitism and philo-Semitism. You know, you had, particularly after the Holocaust, you had people like Marilyn Monroe, and we talk about American icons, and Elizabeth Taylor converting to Judaism, Sammy Davis converting to Judaism. And there's a great joke about Sammy Davis on a bus in the South during Jim Crow, telling the bus driver he's Jewish, when the bus driver tells him to get to the back of the bus. And when he says he's Jewish, the bus driver says, get off the bus. I mean, a lot of these jokes, in other words, work with anti-Semitic themes to show that anti-Semitism is stupid. I mean, it's like the joke about a couple of guys who see a sign and say Jews converted $100, and one of them decides to investigate this. And he's there a long time, and his friend says, "What took you so long?" He says, "Well, I was." And then he immediately says, "And did you get the money?" And he says, "Why is that the thing you people think about?" So, you know, it's anti-Semitic, yeah, but it's funny. What I did was I went to some pains to show jokes that are on, for example, neo-Nazi sites and jokes that have turned up in places that are just rankly and almost devoutly anti-Semitic, and the contrast is pretty sharp and pretty dramatic.
Well, thank you for the call, Bob, and thanks for the question. We have some more. We have a question from Renee who says, I'd be interested in Michael's view on whether there's any difference between Sephardi and Ashkenazi humor.
There is. I tried to explore Sephardic humor to a great degree. And for those who don't know, Ashkenazi humor is mainly Eastern European Jewry. Sephardic humor is mainly Spanish and North African, where Jews were, and particularly places like Morocco and so forth. There's a vast difference. The difference is that Ashkenazi humor rises to a different level than Sephardic humor in terms of using traditional Jewish identity. Sephardic is separate, and it has a separate style of humor. And Sephardic jokes were, frankly, in some ways hard to come by.
Mm-hmm. Anita in Atherton. Hi, Anita. Go ahead.
Good morning, Mike and Kim. It is a treat. I truly, truly love every minute of your talk. I had for many years a wonderful Jewish colleague and friend who would never go out with me until his breast pocket was full of Jewish jokes. Isn't that a lovely memory of a now deceased friend?
Thank you for sharing.
Thank you for that.
That.
And can I say something about that? There's a woman whom some of our listeners know. In fact, she's been on forum, named Marilyn Yalom. Her husband is a famous psychiatrist, Irv Yalom, and she's a famous scholar of French literature and has written a book on marriage and a book on the breast, and is a very productive and important scholarly figure. Both of them are kind of super people in terms of what they give and just as human beings. She came up to me at an event recently I was at, and she said, you know, there's a book called Beyond Good and Evil, a little playing on Nietzsche there, and it's about a woman who was like Anne Frank. She was kind of in an attic for many years and managed to escape the Holocaust. And she said the one thing that the family nurtured on was a book of Jewish jokes. It's a very touching and poignant story. It's like the story I tell in the book about introducing Elie Wiesel, famous writer about the Shoah. And there was a man in the audience who was in Auschwitz with him, and they were sobbing and they were embracing and so forth. I mean, it was really an unbelievably poignant, dramatic moment. And then they started talking about this SS guard and how brutal he was and how sadistic he was and violent and so forth. Then they started talking about his personal habits and started laughing. I mean, because apparently it gave them a source of humor when they were in the camp, and it sustained them. So humor can be much more, you know, Norman Cousins wrote about humor helping our immune system and doing all of these kinds of things for us in terms of our health. Laughter can bring you into a better mood. It can elevate your spirit. It can do so much.
It's a balm. It's a balm. It's a
balm is a good word. Yeah. It can be a balm the other way, too.
Yes, it can be a balm. A balm the other way, too. Was it ever that for you? Was there ever a moment when you needed the properties that a joke provides in terms of a soothing and, you know, balming?
I think so. I have to reflect on that a little more. But the same way music can lift your spirits, I think humor can and certainly has for me. It's not that for example, sometimes I'll go back to a specific joke in my mind and it seems to be a good frame of reference for what may be gnawing at me or disturbing me or bothering me. And it does help.
I remember the joke about the old Jewish man who was on his deathbed and wanted to convert. The very end. Do you mind telling that?
No, it's again a classic joke. He wants to convert, and some again would maybe see this as anti-Semitic. But he had been a pious Jew his whole life, and he'd been very devoted to his religion and had followed it to the letter as much as he possibly could. And he asks to convert to the religion of Jesus, to Christianity, and he says, it doesn't matter what branch. It can be Lutheran, it can be Methodist, it can be Presbyterian. So the family can't believe it, but they go find a minister. They bring him in, and a Protestant minister, and he puts him through the conversion, gives him a baptism and so forth. And his son and daughter both say, we have to ask you, Pa, you've been a pious Jew your whole life. Why did you have this late conversion? It's better one of them than one of us. I mean, there's something so tribal in that, you know. I mean, a lot of people wouldn't embrace that joke, but it's been around a long time.
Joan in Oakland. Hi, Joan.
Morning. Thank you. Hello?
Hi, Joan.
Morning?
Yeah.
Morning. Thanks for taking my call. It sounds like a wonderful book. I would like to get a copy for my 91-year-old daughter, but I'd like to know if it will be out in audiobook.
It will. In fact, I'll leave with a joke and a true story. When they asked me to do an audiobook, the publisher told me, the audiobook company had said, has he had any experience public speaking?
Here's ba-dum-bum. Well, Guy tweets, nail the show order this morning, weed, then jokes. Michael Krasny, thank you so much. It's been an honor to interview.
Thank you, Mina Kim. Delighted to have been with you.
Michael Krasny, our host, has a new book, Let There Be Laughter, A Treasury of Great Jewish Humor and What It All Means. You can also go to our website, kqed.org/forum, for a complete list of his appearances coming up. Thanks so much to all of you for sharing your jokes with us.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.